And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Well, over the last 3 months now, Massachusetts has seen a tremendous step forward in passing climate legislation, something called the Next Generation Climate Bill, which is a sweeping bill, has lots and lots of stuff in it, far more than we'd ever be able to talk about in a single 20-minute podcast. But it's an important bill. It puts Massachusetts back at the in a leadership position of climate action across the United States. And it is a good thing that has happened. And because there's so much good stuff packed into the Next Generation Climate Roadmap bill, we are thrilled to be joined by Representative Jeff Roy, who represents the 10th Norfolk District here in Massachusetts and is chairman of the Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy Committee, the TUE, the very important TUE committee. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a treat to be here.
So I described a little bit about the I think it's the Next Generation Climate Roadmap Bill. Maybe there's a specific name, but tell me, what should people know about it? Why are climate activists dancing in the streets?
Well, it's people should know that Massachusetts has always been a leader in climate change. We lost a little ground over a couple of years, but we're coming roaring back with this landmark piece of legislation, which sets some real ambitious goals for reduction of emissions. And I think that's the overwhelming favorite, that by 2030, we want to have a 50% net reduction. And by 2050, we want to be net zero. And
so just
an important milestone.
A 50% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, which is the junk that comes out of your tailpipe and out of your factories, right? 50% emission by 20. That's great. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. And net zero by 2050.
Net zero by 2050. That's great.
You know, and because, you know, we understand the harm that's being caused to this planet. And we've listened to the scientists, and the scientists have told us, and we're following the science. And we're absolutely thrilled that we have a president in the White House who believes in science and who picked some extremely well-qualified people to be a part of his administration, several of them who come from Massachusetts and who are going to lead this effort to get us to net zero by 2050. And, you know, we're putting a stake in the ground here. But that's, you know, that's just part of it. And setting up roadmaps every 5 years to increase or decrease the level of emissions, and requiring the Secretary of Environment and Energy to produce reports every 5 years about goals and where we're going with regard to meeting our particular goals and limits.
And I think that's such an important fee, if I could interrupt you. That's so important because whoever's going to be governor in 2050 is probably in high school now, right? And so we need short-term goals to force action in the near term. So that's one of the brilliant parts of the legislation, that it really does have teeth to force action in the present, right?
It really does. And, you know, I joked with some folks that during the process of getting this bill done, and working on it, I had this dream one night that I'm going to be 89 years old in 2050. And I had this dream that my wife and my kids were having a birthday party for me. And they put a cake in front of me and it had LED candles. And as I was blowing them out, they said to me, "We think you should know that we've achieved net zero." And I don't know if you remember, but that was back in 2021. You know, thinking of that, you put it in perspective, you know, I'm going to be 89. This bill is not about me or my generation. This bill is about my kids and their generation and what world we're going to pass on to them. And I just can't emphasize how important it is that we take responsibility and give them a climate and a planet that they can enjoy as much as we did.
So let me ask you a question. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the targets that are set for 2030 and beyond, there's emissions reduction targets all along, are based on a renewable portfolio standard, which, can you just briefly say what is the RPS, renewable portfolio standard, and why is that it seems to me that's really a hammer to force clean energy into the system. Is that a fair statement?
There are a number of examples. You know, the renewable portfolio standard, we're calling for a rapid acceleration of the renewable portfolio standard. So we're increasing it by something like 3% per year to make sure that our utilities are going after renewable sources for their energy. To me, the most exciting thing that we're doing in this bill is we increased the amount of procurements for offshore wind up to 5,600 megawatts. Okay. So when we first thought about offshore wind, and it was legislation that we passed in 2016, we required 1,600 megawatts of offshore wind because no one was certain about how it was going to come in terms of a cost, and it was going to be so expensive. But, off the shore of Massachusetts, 14 miles off the shore of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket, we have the most robust source of wind in the contiguous United States. I think I was on a meeting with you last night, and I compared it with Jed Clampett firing his shotgun into the sand and reaching and oil.
It was black gold Texas tea.
That's the quote. Yes, indeed. Well, we have found that same type of energy, which is clean and green, in the ocean. And so we said, let's get 1,600 megawatts out there. And we were not certain what the bids for the energy costs were going to come in. We were thinking it was going to be like 25 cents for a kilowatt hour for energy. And when the bids came in, it was like 6.5 cents. And so in 2018, we asked the executive branch to look into the possibility of another 1,600 megawatts, see if that's feasible, see if it's needed. And about a year later, the executive came back and said, yeah, we should do another 16. We're going to direct that. In fact, the specs went out earlier this year before we passed the new climate bill. So now we're up to 3,200 megawatts of offshore wind. And in this bill, we asked them to do another 2,400 megawatts of offshore wind. So now we're up to 5,600 megawatts of offshore wind. That's enough power to power every home in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and we'll have some excess. We're trying to work out the bugs of where and how we're going to transfer that excess energy. But that is such an example of innovation and cost reduction that has enabled us to use wind power to really supplement our energy portfolio. So you've got a robust solar industry here in Massachusetts. You've got more hydro than I ever knew. I had no idea that we had as much hydro as we have in Massachusetts. And wind power, which is going to start its construction in May of 2021, will be generating wind by 2023 in Massachusetts. And it's just going to continue to grow over the next several years.
Can I ask you kind of a geeky question? But when the legislature says ask for procurement of X amount of wind power, what does that trigger? Does that force the utilities to go find a company to build wind turbines, or does the state hold an auction that then companies come and bid on the opportunity to build? What do you mean when you say you've slated?
We want the utilities to buy from wind sources. Now, Eversource liked the idea so much that they went in as a partner on the second wind project. So the Mayflower Wind, which is going to start in 2022, is a joint venture, and Eversource is one of the partners. So even they see the remarkable benefits of green energy, and they're going to make it a real part of their portfolio. So that's, you know, it's exciting to see that people are moving in this direction.
So the wind energy stuff is really interesting. You're talking about 5,600 megawatts or 5.6 gigawatts, depending on how you want to. I mean, that's installed by 2030. And that would, in some sense,
it would probably be, it may be by 2030
in that frame,
2035 at the outset.
But it's decades of jobs, right? I mean, there's
decades
a lot
of jobs.
I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of wind turbines, presumably, to keep up with that much power. And is there an opportunity for Massachusetts to participate in that kind of a jobs bonanza?
As a matter of fact, there certainly is. And one of the things that I've been tasked with by the Speaker of the House is to investigate and report back to him on offshore wind workforce development. Now, he's tapping into my experience as the former chair of the Higher Education Committee. So I'm going to utilize all of the connections and relationships I built in that committee and translated into the work that I'm doing with TUE. And so I know already that there are seven institutions of higher education in Massachusetts that are doing and developing curriculum for offshore wind. And I'm also working with labor unions, because they're going to play a key role in this, and they need to train workers there. We're talking about credentialing programs that we're going to introduce in Massachusetts, so people don't need to get degrees, but they're going to need some sort of a certificate or credential. We're working on those types of things. We're working with vocational high schools. We're working with traditional high schools. We're working with community colleges, state universities, the UMass system. UMass Amherst has a wind center. UMass Lowell has a wind center. It's just incredible. And I'm leaving out another state university, Mass Maritime Academy. All of these folks are at the forefront, and they're ramping up because there's a lot of jobs out there, and we need to train these workers to do these jobs.
Yeah, thank you for that clear explanation. There's lots of jobs. I mean, one aspect of the bill, I think, which is an excellent thing, is the environmental justice part, but it connects back to the jobs. I mean, there's workforce training. I mean, these many jobs will, I mean, how are they distributed to the people who need them the most, shall we say? I mean, what's the situation there?
There has to be an equitable distribution of the jobs, and we're asking that be considered in the workforce development program. In this bill, we put $12 million to the Mass CEC to do workforce development directly, and the budget is going to be released tomorrow, and I expect that's going to contain some additional funding for workforce training in the offshore wind industry. We know this is a golden opportunity for Massachusetts. We know that Massachusetts likes to be number one in everything it does, and we are poised to be number one in the offshore wind industry. And that's our goal. And I like to think that that we're going to get there, we're going to get there quickly.
As a true son of New Bedford, the whaling port of New Bedford, where I grew up, they have a deep water port and they have a wind turbine, wind blade construction facility.
Yes, they do. And that port was recently constructed to accommodate the massive projects that are going to be constructing these turbines. It's the only port of its kind in North America.
Really?
And it's right there in New Bedford.
There you go.
I was down there just a week ago with the Secretary of Environment and Energy, the mayor of New Bedford, and you know, a bunch of folks talking about this project. And I was looking out at a vast, open, vacant parking lot that will be teeming with activity in a matter of months. And very exciting to see this moving forward.
That's great. That's great. So there's there's so many things. I guess one other thing, well, let me just say, there's a reorientation of the Department of Public Utility. There are building code statements. There are tell me, what's this, this is now MCAN is the organization that I volunteer with. They are MCAN, Massachusetts Climate Action Network, is very interested in the building codes for new buildings, right? And making affordable, clean housing available. There are a lot of changes with respect to building codes in this massive bill. Dear listener, you can already see it. This bill covers a lot of ground. There's a lot.
Certainly does.
Tell me the story about building codes and what's going to happen there.
So the building codes, so we had a stretch energy code that communities who wanted to be green communities had to adopt. So
these were building codes for new buildings that would be highly energy efficient, right? So it's
exactly.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to be a green community and have access to additional funding for your community, you had to adopt this energy code. We've heard from some communities who wanted to go even further. They wanted to get into the net zero building construction phase. And so we've asked the administration over the next 18 months to develop a net zero building code that will, it'll be opt-in. No community has to do it, but they'll have the option to do it. And it's going to require net zero building performance standards and a definition of a net zero building. It will allow the public to have input on the development of those regulations. We heard a lot from industry and labor unions who had some concerns. Well, the way we phrased the drafting of the regulations, it'll give them an opportunity to participate in the development of those regulations. And you know, the important thing is, and I've said to you know, the building folks and the labor union folks, I said, it's difficult for me to conceive that in 2021 that any developer is not thinking about net zero, because who wants to buy a building in 10 years that needs to be retrofitted? So everybody who's in this business today ought to be thinking ahead to what net zero is all about. And I think the timing couldn't be better for the development of that new code.
It, as you say, the law calls for a definition of what net zero means. But let me put in a plug that one potential definition of net zero, just so that people listening can understand, is that your home would be essentially electric. So there would not be a gas hookup. Your home would be heated with a heat pump. Your stove would be an induction stove, and all that kind of stuff is a way to avoid building a house that will probably be standing when Jeff's 89 years old, right? And you don't want natural gas in it at that point. So these are, as we said, the opt-in code, so people can choose to do it, but it exists. It would be defined. It would be well thought out, which is a great advance, right?
Right. You know, and another thing, you know, hopefully carbon capture will, you know, become further developed so that, you know, if there are emissions, they're going to get captured and they're going, you know, there are all ways that science and innovation are going to help us to get on this path. And as we develop these regulations and codes, we can take advantage of science and innovation. I mean, I'm looking at every possible way to provide the energy that we need. And keep in mind, as we go more electric, and we put more electric vehicles on the road, the demand for more electricity is going to be there. And we, you know, we have to keep that in mind as we develop our sources of energy. And, you know, as an aside, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I made the transition to an electric vehicle in 2012, and I'm on my third one to this date. And I realized back in 2012 when I got my first that the infrastructure wasn't really there. And, you know, I had that anxiety about going too far on an electric vehicle and not having the ability to power it. So I went with the Chevy Volt, which has a gas generator in it. So just in case, I could always turn to gas. Well, I've been driving a Volt from 2012 to 2021. And now I'm more comfortable with the infrastructure. So my next vehicle, which I have an order in for my next one, will be all electric. I feel comfortable enough that the infrastructure is there and the range of these vehicles is long enough that I don't think I'm going to get stuck anywhere with the vehicle. But, you know, that is something. And folks have said to me, well, all this climate change legislation and these requirements for electric vehicles are going to cost people more money. Well, I'll share with you my personal experience. I had a vehicle that got probably 12 to 15 miles to the gallon in 2012, and I was spending close to $300 to $350 a month on gasoline. And of course, back at that time, it was $4 a gallon. I switched to the Volt, and my gas bill went down to $35 a month. And there are some months that I pay even less. So I'm saving $300 a month. Granted, the car was a little bit more expensive, but with a federal tax credit and a state incentive, it really balanced out. So I'm not paying any more money to drive an electric car. In fact, I'm saving money by driving an electric car. So, and I think you'll see that in many of the contexts as you make the conversion. So I don't want people to fear that it's going to be so costly and that they're going to be, costed out of energy efficiency.
Oh, Jeff, I think that that's fascinating. We probably should put down this discussion, although we could go on. I mean, I have 10 more questions, so maybe have to come back another time and we can continue talking. But what I'll do is that we'll put up links to some of the stuff that we've made reference tonight. That'll be on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you want, if you have a question about the podcast or suggestions of stuff that we should be talking about or whatever, send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. I'm sure you're listening to this podcast on your smartphone using some modern podcast distribution app. Please ask your friends to listen to the show on their iPhones, on their favorite modern podcast distribution apps. We're everywhere. You can find us, of course, on Apple Podcasts by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his research support. We want to close the way we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. Well, Jeff, I think that you've put Massachusetts on a good road to do all of those three things of building a safe and sustainable future. So I want to thank you so much for being here and taking the time to chat.
Well, thank you. And I just want to remind you that it's a House of 160 members and a Senate of 40 members that really came together to put these bills together.
Absolutely.
This is a team effort. We have some great people and great leadership in the legislature. So I'm just happy to be a part of that team.
That's great. That's great. Well, thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.